The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krakowski, in Paris. And this week, the team in the London studio include
Alex Hearn
and Sam Gibbs.
Coming up on this week's show:
people listening to your podcast today, how many hours per day are you actually having headphones in? You start adding that up and you go, this is great for the headphone market, because you realize the headphones that came out of the box are good, but you can get better and it's not going to be that much more expensive necessarily.
Samuel talks to Seth Combs, founder of the Soul Republic brand of headphones, about why increasingly we're all fans of super cans and why, when it comes to personal accessories, the headphones are the new hat. And we'll be talking to The Guardian's James Ball about a recent encounter he had with the people who hold the keys to the internet. Yes, the keys to the internet. Also, the team and I look at the rise and the plummet of Bitcoin exchange Mt. Gox, Facebook's buying a fleet of drones, and Google's Project Tango opens up a brave new three-dimensional world of phone apps. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
I am Vince. Vince Clortho, key master of Gozer. Volga Sildro, our lord of the Sebulia. Are you the gatekeeper?
Hey, he pulls the wagon. I make the deals. You want to ride?
Nightmare scenario. I'll just come out and say it. The internet goes down. We have no access to our externalized brains, our social worlds, our financial institutions. The globe goes into meltdown. Society is in chaos. The end of the world? Nigh. Well, thankfully, as The Guardian's James Ball discovered recently in a nondescript office in a nondescript part of Los Angeles, there's a cabal of people who have the key to the internet. James joins us down the line. Welcome, James, to Tech Weekly.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So I'm very curious about this key ceremony. Immediately, I started thinking about all of the things, you know, the link that we heard before was from Ghostbusters. You see, Rick Moranis wants to be the keymaster, is looking for the keymaster. And I also thought about the offices, this gen is the internet scene. What exactly was the key ceremony? Because frankly, it sounds made up.
The whole thing sounds bizarre, doesn't it? We more or less chase this as an urban myth, this idea of some kind of key to the internet. And obviously, nothing in real life is quite as dramatic as you would like. It's not quite something that could turn the internet off or on again. And unfortunately, you know, they don't wear them around their necks with hooded robes and chant. But there is quite a strange little tale. They have this kind of high security facility. It's exactly what the NSA uses for top secret documents and so on. It's, you know, no electric signals get in and out. You've got to get past armed guards and iris scanners and key cards. And it's all to do with essentially trying to make the core of the internet a bit more secure. And they're trying to make everyone trust it. And so they have key holders from around the world. And they gather together to sign this thing, essentially, to try and say, hey, you know, no one can have a back door. It can't be controlled by one government or one company. We've all got to get together in this very strange and elaborate arrangement in order to do anything with this.
It sounds utterly fascinating that there are, 20 people who have keys to the internet, you know, to this sort of mythical centralized internet. And they are ultimately protecting us. They're sort of creating a more secure system. But I thought that in the first place, the idea about the internet is that A, it was decentralized, and B, you know, that's why it was so secure, is because it was decentralized. So tell me a little bit about how this ceremony came about.
So the idea is trying to make its web addresses really more secure. So, you know, when you type in theguardian.com into your browser, as I'm sure we all do regularly, I hope, what it's really doing is it looks up a series of decentralized phone books to go, okay, .com, where should I look to find where a .com is? And then The Guardian. And so it looks at in like a series of phone books to find like the unique address for where The Guardian website lies, which is actually a whole string of numbers called an IP address. Now, the problem is people can lie about those. You can essentially have a dodgy entry. So if you type it in China, China will give you a false answer because they block The Guardian right now. If you were unlucky and hit a kind of server run by fraudsters, they might put you to a site that looks like The Guardian but gives you a virus. So they're trying to make this more secure by essentially signing it, like putting a bit of crypto on it so that you know for sure that the address you'll be given is the right one. But the thing is, any kind of system like that relies on a set of keys. And ultimately, the way they've decided to do this, it's a whole bunch of sort of keys behind keys behind keys. And so regular sort of normal decentralized servers just sort of sign on their own behalf. But they go, but hey, if you don't believe us, throw back to this one, then throw back to this one. And at the very heart of it lies this master key that signs what they call the root zone. And so they all really try hard not to say it, but it's essentially this one key to rule them all. And nowhere else on the internet or even on the planet, not even the passport system, works like this. So if it actually catches on, it's a really, you know, it's a unique concept.
So why is it in the U.S.? I understand that this is a bit of a controversial location, not just, of course, because of the revelations about the NSA, but also simply because it suggests that the U.S. is in charge of the security of the Internet.
It kind of does, and a lot of people don't feel good about that. So I don't think you would ever really think of it, but the people who run this whole system, which is called the Domain Name System, it's a California-based not-for-profit. And really, they can't give you a good answer about why they're in charge of it. It's just, you know, the internet grew up quite informally. They started doing it, and now they've kept doing it. And so because they're based in America, the system's there. And actually, quite a few of the key holders are trying to persuade them to set up a ceremony room outside of America. But at the minute, they're dragging their feet. So they've kind of got halfway there. They've realized they've got to have actual independent international people having a lot of control over the process. But at the minute, it's all on U.S. soil. That bit really does need fixing. I mean, the big challenge for this sort of weird network of organizations that control a lot of the architecture of the internet is they all lean American. And people don't trust that quite as much as they used to. And so some countries are trying to put the UN in charge. Some countries are trying to say, hey, we don't really want that, but why don't we try and make these organizations more international? And so partly fueled by Snowden and partly just long-running politics, who actually gets to run these institutions that the internet relies on and these kind of invisible backroom bits? It's kind of a big debate this year.
What's also interesting is that they've brought human beings back into the system. Now, these are human beings from around the world, aren't they? It's not just U.S. people who hold these various fragments of keys, is it?
No, that's absolutely sort of crucial to why the system's trusted. So the ceremony I was at last month, you had people from, you had a guy over from Moscow, someone from Uruguay, someone from Spain. Someone came over from Sweden, and so it's actual humans back, and it's a whole string of keys within keys within keys. It's one of the key holders I met. She has hers on a chain so she could wear it around her neck, and it's a key to a safety deposit box, which is in a safe, and then that's got a cryptographic smart card inside, and that smart card activates a machine. But only if there's other ones. It's kind of this amazing, elaborate, convoluted system.
It feels like 1950s, like the Andromeda Strain. You know, it feels like the sort of the incredibly paranoid 1950s science fiction. And human error is absolutely rife here. Absolutely rife. Aren't humans supposed to be the weakest link anyway?
Humans always are the weakest link, but that's why they have such a kind of long list of precautions. I mean, what they try and say is, you know, they're not trying to build a system that could stand up to an armed sort of infraction. What they're trying to do is make sure no one could mess with it invisibly.
So what would happen ultimately if one of the keys was lost or stolen? Is there a hotline number like you get for your mobile phone? Or what if the master key itself is lost or stolen?
Seven people have the ability to essentially recreate the key or make a new one from scratch. But for the rest of the time, they've kind of got a few safeguards built in. So seven people at each site have a key. They only need three to keep things going. So if someone loses a key to a safety deposit box, it's fine, they can replace the safe. You know, they've tried to build a system so that it's kind of built in that the odd human can do stuff. So those safety deposit boxes that the key holders have are in a safe that none of them know the combination to. So, and the people who know the combination to the safe aren't key holders, etc. And so the idea is any one person can forget a code or lose a key and the whole system doesn't fall apart. If seven of them suddenly have collective amnesia, then we might start to have some trouble.
Thank you very much, James Ball. You can read James's coverage on theguardian.com/technology. And you can watch the ceremony, which was streamed live in all of its scintillating and, as far as I'm aware, James, from your coverage, enlightening and riveting ceremonial experience at ICANN's website. A few weeks ago on Tech Weekly, our own Alex Hearn gave us the rundown on a digital cryptocurrency called Bitcoin. We watched with unironic eagerness as Bitcoin's US dollar value went up and up and up and down and up again, floating on a bubble of mathematical, technological, computerized hot air. And now Bitcoin has achieved its greatest challenge. Mt. Gox, the Bitcoin broker, originally established as an exchange for another very modern currency. Fact fans, that's from the tabletop card game Magic the Gathering. Well, it went dark. Very, very dark. And now, Alex, it's filed for bankruptcy. What is the story here?
So, once upon a time, Mt. Gox was the largest exchange of Bitcoins in the world. 70% of people looking to buy Bitcoins with normal everyday currency, US dollars, British pounds, Japanese yen, went to Mt. Gox to buy it. This was not even that long ago. In April 2013, it hit that market share. Even deeper in the midst of time, like you say, it was a exchange for Magic the Gathering online. They didn't actually ever sell physical cards. It was an exchange for the online version of the trading card game, which is about as odd a beginning as you can get. Since its heady days in April of last year, though, there's been problems at Mt. Gox. In June last year, it initiated a hiatus on all dollar withdrawals. They said this was because there were problems with the wires, like problems wiring money into US bank accounts, but it led to people getting a bit uneasy, obviously. If you've got a lot of money in a place that's not letting you get it, you want to get it out as soon as you can. They stumbled on until January this year, when at the end of the month, they then put a hiatus on Bitcoin withdrawals as well. They became, in essence, a monopoly money exchange. You could buy Bitcoins and you could buy dollars, but whatever you bought, you couldn't ever take it out again. That obviously was an unsustainable position to be in. And in mid-February, the exchange announced, well, it didn't announce anything. In mid-February, the exchange just turned off its website.
So we aren't just talking about fabricated currency. Well, fabricated currencies, yes, but we're not just talking about sort of fake currencies. We're not actually just talking about monopoly money and the little red and blue houses that you could stick on your board. We're actually talking about things that people invested quite a significant amount of money in, haven't we?
Right, yes. When Mt. Gox turned off its servers and eventually they were powered back up to a certain extent, there was just a very short statement from the CEO saying that they'd gone on hiatus to preserve the stability of their company. That all blew up a bit when they filed for bankruptcy 2 days ago in Japan. When they turned off their servers, a leaked document was made public revealing that they had lost. And they actually did say lost. They didn't, at the time, give any real reason for it, but that they'd lost 750,000 bitcoins. At the current exchange rate, that's worth in the order of £200 million.
Oh, my goodness. Whoa.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Whoa. Wow, I'm literally flabbergasted.
It's 6% of every Bitcoin in existence. I mean, for comparison, if you lost that quantity of pound coins or of British hard currency, you would have lost £4 trillion. It's an astronomical amount of money to just disappear in a fledgling currency. But the thing is, as Mt. Gox's lips have loosened up over the last couple of days, the story that they've been telling has holes in it. They blamed the loss of this 750,000 bitcoins on something called transaction malleability. Essentially, there's this weird flaw in Bitcoin, and it is in Bitcoin itself, where you can make a transaction and then change its name after you've made it. someone who codes a well-built Bitcoin website, this is no problem. Mt. Gox was emphatically not a well-coded Bitcoin website. And so what happened is essentially you could make a transaction, change its name, and then tell them that the transaction had failed. They would look up the name. It wasn't there. They'd send you the money again. It seems likely that they did, in fact, lose a few Bitcoins to this odd flaw. But 750,000 Bitcoins, to lose that many through a very simple flaw and through something which would require them to, in essence, repeatedly go into their reserves to top up their active money without ever noticing that they had this leak, it beggars belief. What's more, they're not just short on Bitcoins. Their bankruptcy documents reveal that they're actually $30 million short as well. That's something that they can't blame on hackers, and they haven't really given a satisfactory explanation as to where that money actually went.
So you are our resident Bitcoin expert, and I truly believe that there are depths that we have not yet scratched when it comes to your Bitcoin knowledge, and I'm looking forward to doing just that in the future. However, for now, with your expertise, can you tell me what you think went wrong for Mt. Gox?
It's really, really hard to tell. I mean, I can tell you the community's theories. One of them is that in 2011, when Mt. Gox very publicly suffered a hacking attack, that actually they may also have lost all of their Bitcoins then and been operating on essentially a fractional reserve, the way the modern banking system works, with just a very small number of Bitcoins, just about using their incomings to cover their outgoings. Obviously, the problem with that is the minute you start getting too many outgoings, everything goes to pieces. Another possibility that people have cited is they may have simply lost the key to their reserves. The way you run a secure Bitcoin exchange is the bulk of your money should not be connected to a computer that is connected to the internet. You can store it on a key drive. You can store it on an offline computer. You can even store it in something called a brain wallet, where essentially you use a piece of software to generate a human memorable string of words, which you then memorize, and at any time you can turn it back into a password, but the password is never written down. It is possible, and people have been reading into comments from the company's CEO, things like, we don't have the money right now. People think that maybe they just lost the key, or they programmed the software that generated the key wrongly, and that they are trying desperately to get back their money. But, you know, people like reading things into public statements, especially when they don't have any other information. The other example, the other theory is that maybe it's all the government's fault. Mt. Gox was in the Bitcoin business. Silk Road was in the Bitcoin business. It's relatively uncontroversial to claim that a lot of Silk Road money will have gone through Mt. Gox. Maybe the American government, in combination with the Japanese government, where Mt. Gox is hosted, froze their accounts and put a gagging order on them. And obviously that would leave any company insolvent.
Why would they do that, though? Why would the secret government conspire?
Why would the government conspire is relatively easy. There is drug money floating around the Bitcoin community. It's undoubtable the biggest use of Bitcoin for 2 or 3 years was to buy illegal drugs. Why they do it secretly? Well, that's mostly so that the Bitcoin community don't have to own up to the fact that there's absolutely no real evidence that the government have conspired in this way at all. The fourth possibility is that there was something underhand happening at Mt. Gox, or just that there was plain old incompetency. Anyone can run a business badly and lose a lot of money. It happens in every industry, and it may just have happened here as well.
For all of our Bitcoin coverage, go to theguardian.com/technology. Drones, everybody's got them. The government, search engines, online retail emporiums. I'm surprised we can still see the clouds given the number of autonomous flying robots in the air. But the skies are about to get even more crowded. The number one social network in the world, yes, Facebook, has caved into peer pressure, ironic, and is lining up its own fleet. They say, Samuel, that it's purely for charitable purposes.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's the assumption, at least. Who knows, in reality? Really, what this is about, Facebook is looking to support its internet.org Initiative, which, for those who don't know, is a conglomeration of six mobile phone and network specialists, including Nokia and Ericsson and Samsung, with Facebook to effectively connect, or attempt to connect, the next 5 billion people to the internet. And at least that's the grand aim of things.
So going back just a second, the relationship is now with somebody called Titan Aerospace.
Yes, indeed. So the drone aspect of this comes from a company called Titan Aerospace, which was founded in 2012 by Max Yaney with the sole purpose of designing what they described as Atmosats. So those are atmospheric satellites. The drones are effectively used as an alternative to launching an orbital satellite, flying very high in the sky and doing more or less what you could do with an orbital satellite, but with something that was significantly less expensive and doesn't require a massive rocket to fire this thing into the sky. So what we're really talking about here is a solar-powered drone that flies around about 20 kilometers high in the sky and can do so unaided, without refueling, without landing, for something in the region of about 5 years.
It's a really nice example of how the word drone is almost useless. You hear drone, you hear Facebook's bought drones, and your first thought is military. Your second thought maybe is, oh, well, they're going to put cameras on them. Your third thought is, are they going to start selling them? No, in this case, it's a satellite. It's a satellite that just doesn't quite orbit or really go in space.
Yes, it's an environmentally friendly satellite.
Marvellous.
So the idea is then to use Titan Aerospace's Atmosats to beam down the internet? That's pretty science fiction.
Yes, it's actually not quite as far-fetched as you might assume. It's a bit like Facebook's version of Google's Project Loon, which was kind of like a ballpark idea to send balloons high up into the atmosphere, floating above countries and areas of land that don't have infrastructure, and effectively creating a mobile network or something similar beamed from the sky rather than from the earth. And with these drones flying up there for 5 years or so, out of the way of jets and things like that, it's totally possible to fit them out with network gear and basically mesh them together across a surface of land and create almost instant infrastructure.
So whose jurisdiction is this drone space, this sort of in-between space and jet space? And how does one apply for 11,000 drones to cover Africa?
That is a very good question. In the US, the 20 km up area, once you're actually there, is above American airspace. And it's a difficult question to answer across the world because quite a lot of places aren't nearly as rigorous in their legislation of the airspace over the top of it. So we get into the sticky area of international airspace, and at that point more or less can do what you like. The problem is getting the drone up there in the first place. I mean, by all intents and purposes, it has to fly up there. If you look at it, it does look like a very, very ultralight aircraft with a propeller one end and wings, and traditional wings and a tail, and it flies up there over a period of time. Now, to get 11,000 of them together supposedly takes around about an estimated $60 million to buy a company, more or less. Or that's the current ballpark figure that's being banded around for the purchase of Titan Aerospace. And if anybody can do it, Facebook definitely can. I mean, just look at the $19 billion they just spent on WhatsApp to know quite how much buying power Facebook has.
And you can read up on all the drone wars at theguardian.com/technology. As we are all finally admitting, the search engine Google is no longer just a search engine. Now, along with their fleet of sentient robot dogs, their flying balloons that can beam the internet anywhere, and office tool suites, they're also developing new interaction experiences for the internet that we carry in our pockets. Google released a video of Project Tango, a new phone that they claim will give handheld devices a, quote, human-scale understanding of space and motion. I'm quoting our own Alex Hearn, who I believe is quoting Google themselves. Alex has been following the story along with Samuel Gibbs. So, Alex, where has Project Tango come from?
More generally, it's come from general research into giving devices and software a better understanding of the world that they're actually in. The thing about computers is that right now you need to give them a lot of information for them to work out how a 3D world looks the way that we do automatically. A classic example of this is if you close one eye and touch your fingers together, everyone's done that thing where, oh yeah, sometimes they miss and you're a bit surprised. But at the same time, if you close one eye and scan the surface in front of you, you can relatively easily work out what's in front of what's behind what, how far away things are. If you see a building, just because you have one eye closed, you don't think that actually you might be staring at a tiny building 2 feet in front of you. You can have a pretty good guess that it is, in fact, building-sized. Those are hurdles that computers haven't really passed yet. Right now, companies try and beat them with data. So you end up with something like Microsoft's Kinect camera, which uses two lenses and a third infrared sensor to get very, very high quality 3D data. Google is attempting to dial that back a bit. Project Tango still has stereoscopic cameras, so it can look at the world in the same way that we do with our two eyes, if you have two eyes. But also, you know, it involves a lot more software-based number crunching, essentially trying to work out how to use more limited data than most developers are comfortable with to work out things like the shape of a room, the way you're moving through a building. Really quite useful stuff, like maybe how you travel around underground, where we still have terrible ways of actually marking location data because no signals can get through.
I thought it was a nice stroke of genius to have Johnny Lee, the developer who famously created a kind of 3D perspective using a Nintendo Wii sensor and the Wiimote to demonstrate this. Because in many ways, Samuel, the pitch behind it, certainly the visual pitch behind it for consumers like me rather than for developers like, well, developers, is that it will have it's a very similar look and feel to that innovation that Johnny himself had built. So what actually is the pitch for developers? What, you know, that's the sexy bit for me. What's the sexy bit for developers?
So the thing for developers is this is the first time that this kind of capability, this data capture and this rich 3D representation of a real world is available in something that is a phone. I mean, we are looking at a 5-inch Android phone here. So instead of being, say, like, it's a very similar technology to the one used by one of the Mars rovers that was launched a decade ago. But instead of being a massive truck, this thing fits in your pocket. And so for developers, it gives them amazing data in real time, in real space, and on real people rather than in some lab somewhere. So that's the real edge here. The possibilities are almost endless for this kind of thing, even the visual 3D space is concerned. And it provides an absolute ton of data across kind of things like depth, orientation, distance and motion and speed and acceleration. So all these things can be fed into all sorts of innovative applications or anything like that. For example, looking at it from the point of view of a developer, this could be one of the best game controllers ever made. You've got something that you can move around in 3D space. It knows where it's going. It's basically like a super advanced Wiimote, but in a phone, and you could take it anywhere, and it knows where it is in 3D space. So you just snap a picture of your house, and then that becomes the playing field. You know, that becomes the area which you can map with World of Warcraft or something like that.
I'm now really excited about this game.
We'll do one in the master control room in Studio One. But Alex, what are some of the other things? I mean, games, people often think about sort of user interaction. They think about these types of interaction tools, whether it's touchscreen or whether it's a Wiimote or whether it's even an old-fashioned joystick, immediately in terms of games. But what are some of the other applications that this could pertain to?
Well, the most obvious one is mapping. What Google has shown is essentially a device which you wander into a room, wave it a bit, and get a full, accurate 3D map of that room. Do that throughout a building and you have a 3D map of the building. Upload that to Google Maps, which I'm sure Google wouldn't be sad if you did. And you've given them yet more data that lets them, in the nice way, help us find our way around, in the, you know, slightly more cynical way, know everything about our lives. Part of the reason for Google announcing Project Tango now is because it's kind of clear that they're not really sure what can be done with it in a specific way. They've announced it and asked developers to come forward with pitches for what they would use the Project Tango phone for. Google has given ideas. They mention navigation. They mention alternate reality, you know, superimposing a virtual view onto an image of the real world. They mention gaming, obviously. But what they want is they want other people to come in and actually go, oh my God, this is really exciting technology, and here is something that you haven't thought of that I want to do with it. Doubtless there will be. There's always people looking for interesting ways to use new technology. And it's actually quite nice that Google has decided to do that now rather than waiting and launching with some, you know, probably okay in-house applications and then everyone having to wait another 2 years after the developers get hold of the release thing for actually to see what can be done with it.
Well, if you're a developer or if you're a consumer like me and just want to see some cool future stuff, then you can see the coverage and watch the video at theguardian.com/technology. They were invented in 1910 for the US Navy. And in 1958, consumers had their first listen. And in 2013, the headphones industry was worth over £5 billion. 284 million units shipped, according to consumer consultancy FutureSource, and there is no indication that the market is slowing down. It's forecast to grow 5% annually over the next 5 years. Samuel, you spoke with one of the next generation headphone manufacturers for Tech Weekly. How much do you think that he feels indebted to Nathaniel Baldwin, the first guy to invent cans?
I should think he basically worships him. I mean, he came up with the idea of making headphones when nobody had any concept of headphones. It was designed in a space where you didn't really have amplifiers. So the only way you could listen to an audio stream, which was literally just a waveform along an electric wire, was to have a small speaker that didn't really require a lot of power to get it going. And I mean, when we're talking about speakers in those days, we're not talking about the neodymium magnet powered things we have around our heads and in our laptops, etc. Now, they were tiny, like almost mechanical machines that had to be moved. So talking about industrial scale stuff.
And of course, since then, they have become an enormous industry, everything from Beats to, well, Soul Republic. And Samuel, you met Seth Combs, the founder of Soul Republic. What did he have to say?
When I met Seth, I asked him basically, how do we go from these cheap headphones that everybody seems to get with their iPod to the kind of £300 beasts that we see out on the street? And how did the modern revolution of the headphones start?
I mean, even since the 50s and 60s, you can trace these headphones out there from the Bose to the Sennheisers. You know, they've always been there, even Sony's, where DJs have been wearing the big over the years. You got a lot of audiophiles that were wearing them back in the day and consistently. And I think what you saw is with the iPod and those wide earbuds, the very first inkling or seedling of it being also a fashion accessory. Then enters Skullcandy, then enters Beats by Dre, and you get everyone wearing them, right? And all of a sudden, you turn on the television and your favorite football players, rocking these, right? And all these fashion icons and people out there that you're consistently looking at, every celebrity's wearing them. And it really changes the landscape completely.
So do you think it was that kind of celebrity endorsement, as it were, that really fired this into the public consciousness?
Well, I think it's a slew of things, right? I think since the iPod and then with smartphones, the growth of smartphones, there was a study I read a year back that O2 had done, and they talked about it, and they go, what do you use your smartphone for? And the number five thing was making phone calls.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And so before that was texting, but then it's video games, it's movies, it's music, because you're losing, everyone wants to escape. You can be on the tube and no one wants to talk to each other. No one wants to. You can see kids in the back seat. My niece and nephews are the quietest kids when you're in a car with them now because they all have headphones on and they're holding their Kindle. That's been part of it. I think the celebrity aspect, the fashion aspect has helped drive it to that next level because now everyone wears jeans and a t-shirt. So what's your accessory? It's your watch, your hat, if you wear a hat, and it's your shoes and now headphones.
So the headphones are the new hat.
It's part of it. I think it's part of it. I think it definitely plays into a perspective of it, which is why when we launched our headphones, we go, we're going to make them interchangeable, because we realize there's an actual identity component to it where you actually want to customize it to what your style is on any given day. If you look at the market, you know, if you looked at the market as a whole, we said there's no headphones really sub, you know, 100 pounds, if you will, that look good, that are designed from scratch, that, you know, have the durability we want. So when we launched our first headphone, the Trax, you know, for 79 pounds, you get the first headphone that is completely interchangeable, meaning you can actually swap out not only the headband, but the cables too, virtually indestructible and still offers great sound. You know, we spent over a year working on that and designing it from scratch.
Generally, people's space, especially in Britain, people are living closer and closer together. Their flats are smaller. They're less isolated from individual people. So the possibility of having a big sound system at home is shrinking. I mean, without annoying the hell out of your neighbors, you basically can't really go for it. Do you think the headphones have replaced the hi-fi? So are headphones the new hi-fi of the 2014?
I think headphones are the next big speaker, if you will, for personal use. I mean, still, I mean, for the video games, for movies, for, you know, audio in that way. But I still think you will see a real movement and a trend over the next, you know, few years too, where you see really compact speaker systems at home that, you know, can actually deliver the sound you want. Like, it's kind of the move you've seen right now with soundbars.
Yeah.
Right? And I think you're going to get into that realm as well around the home.
I mean, one thing that's interested me is this expansion of the expensive headphones, expensive, good quality, great sound, not necessarily reflected in the devices that we're actually playing them from. So do you think there's going to be a movement to higher quality audio? I mean, we saw Neil Young attempt to effectively create a high fidelity iPod, as it were. Do you think there's a space for that?
I think there's a space for that. I think it takes a lot of time. I really do. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, Steve Jobs was pushing for higher quality downloads, and I think people want that, you know. But I don't know if you remember, you know, when you'd go on iTunes, it was 99 cents or 129 for HD, and it becomes price elasticity, and do I really need it, and do I understand what I'm getting? You know, most people didn't know that music they were getting was so compressed. And I think it's a real education issue as well.
So do you think users are not as savvy as they should be to music quality?
I just don't think. I mean, I think you don't think about it, right? Because, I mean, I can get any album at any time on a streaming service too. Well, what's the quality of that? Is that uncompressed? You know, we went from LPs to 8-tracks to cassettes to CDs, and we kept moving up and up in quality. And then we went to compressed music, you know, in these audio files. And I think it's just changed the landscape completely. And I think you definitely have people seeking out higher quality, but it's not everyone. I don't think it's the masses yet.
And do you think, talking about streaming services, I mean, Spotify has been kind of instigated kind of music revolution. Do you think that's good for the headphone market? I mean, more people listening to more music equals more people seeking out good headphones.
Absolutely. I mean, I think all of it's good for the entire headphone market around the smartphone or the tablet. And the reason being is, you know, if you look at it, if you really think about it, people listening to your podcast today, right? People that listen to anything or are listening or playing a video game, how many hours per day are you actually having headphones on? You start adding that up and you go, this is great for the headphone market, because you realize the headphones that came out of the box are good, but you can get better and it's not going to be that much more expensive necessarily.
Mm. So do you think, I mean, one thing that's been levied at the rise of the large expensive cans is that it's a craze and verging into fashion. Kind of fashion has a funny way of dumping crazes. Do you think that headphones can go past the fashion aspect and really be a mainstay? Or do you think it's going to be a rise and fall like fashion?
Well, I think, you know, I think headphones as a whole are going to continue to rise. I think you're right, though. You've gotten a lot of trendy things. I mean, how many celebrity headphones came out over the last 5 years, right?
And it's basically everyone with a brand seems to have one.
Exactly. And I think that was a trend. And I think there's different trends out there. But I think headphones as a whole, won't. And I think you're going to see that continue to grow. Like in-ears, for instance, huge growth still too. Because there are phones out there like the new Moto X phone where you open it up and there are no headphones in there.
Mm.
Right? So what are you going to do? Well, you have to go buy an aftermarket headphone. And so now it becomes part of it. And the same thing with the iPad mini I just recently purchased.
One thing I am personally interested in is the wireless headphones. Now, I bought a pair of Bluetooth headphones about 4 years ago because I was just absolutely frustrated by the cable getting caught in my commute. Effectively, I'd snag it with a hand as I was reaching up for the bar, and it would take my almost my head off. But Bluetooth headphones are generally expensive, and if you buy a cheap set of Bluetooth headphones, they normally battery life is horrendous, and the sound quality is bad. But they're often also really big. Where do you see Bluetooth headphones, for instance, or wireless headphones in general going?
We just launched, and we're just launching in the UK, a new set of headphones called Trax Air. Bluetooth technology has not been there, right? Has not been there. You haven't been able to get wireless headphones that sound good. You know, you put the phone in your pocket and people are leaning their head over to make sure, you know, they're still within line of sight, and it's scary. A lot of neck injuries, right? It's good for the chiropractic industry, but not for us. And so with us, what we did is we teamed up with Motorola, because we go, who is leading the technology? Who's the best at this? And Motorola is one of the top companies out there. And we worked with their engineers to create the Trax Air, which is off our Trax platform here. But they're still interchangeable, right?
Right.
They're completely interchangeable still. But what we did is we put a metal inlay within the actual headband now. And what that allowed us to do is put all the technology in only one sound engine.
Oh, I see.
Right? So it's only all the technologies just in one sound engine. So now you got two microphones in that. You got a 15-hour battery life in that. But the best part, too, the range and the sound that you're talking about, 45 meters. Okay, 45 meters is an incredible length. Now you can actually walk around the room. You could be on a conference call if you wanted to and walk out and actually still be connected, which is incredible. And on top of that, we understand the key frustrations for, you know, tech heads, people that love technology as much as we do, that love music as much as we do. So what we did is we're the first headphone out there that has dual device technology. What that means is you can not only pair via Bluetooth or NFC to your phone, but you can also pair to your tablet and switch back and forth seamlessly.
The 45-meter range, do you need a specific phone for that? I mean, what's it based on? Is it based on Bluetooth 4.0?
It's not. It's basic Bluetooth.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. It's not even Bluetooth 4.0. You don't need a special phone whatsoever. And, you know, that's 45 meters. But the good thing about us is now you can walk around, and you got the ability, you got the wireless freedom you need. But I think you're dead on. Wireless is where it needs to go, because you need to cut the cord. What we did as well, though, is with the 15-hour battery life, you know, most other wireless headphones on the market, when the battery's dead, the music's dead.
Mm.
And so we actually added a passive capability, so you can actually plug a cable in if you wanted to.
And does it sound the same wired through via Bluetooth?
Absolutely.
So it's obvious when you look at brands like Beats, I mean, they're targeting a specific music genre. What's Soul Republic's bent in that regard?
Well, you know, when we started it, there's three co-founders of the company. It's Kevin Lee, Scott Hicks, and myself. When we started it, we said, you know, we're music lovers. We believe if music sounds better, it feels better. At the end of the day, though, we're music lovers, and we listen to every genre of music pretty much. And Kevin Lee is pretty much our top secret weapon, you know, for incredible sound, too. He works with the engineers and our acoustical engineers as well to make sure we get a sound that works not only for, like you're saying, like a certain genre, like hip-hop or something, but works for country or classical music. And if you listen to our headphones, they have an incredible balance. You know, they have bass, but they're not over bass heavy. You know, you still get the highs and the mids, and you get the clarity you expect too.
So do you think that kind of that balance is key? I mean, one of the detractors I found in quite a lot of the big style headphones is that they're the equivalent of putting a sub in the boot of your car. They are all bass, and all you hear is this whoop, 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 and it basically destroys the music. I mean,
we feel the same way. You know, bass, too much bass, it hides everything. And it hides the mids. And most people, you know, we always say this, bad sound is objective, good sound is subjective. And it's so true. And for us, most people don't realize how good mids can sound, how good highs can sound, because it's being masked by too much bass.
So less bass, more punch, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for joining us in the booth, and we look forward to trying out some more of your headphones.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's all we have for you this week. Thank you very much to our guest, Seth Combs from Seoul Republic, and of course, the whole Tech Weekly team. Remember, for reviews of the best consumer tech, plus analysis, comments, and much more, go to theguardian.com/technology. I'm Alex Kratosky. Our producer is Jason Phipps. Thanks for listening. We're back next Wednesday. See you then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.